The High Level Showdown is proud to celebrate its 150th episode, and we're going to celebrate it by having a very special live show for all our listeners. So you can come out on December the 6th, 2018, to the Grislar Coffee and Records here on Jasper Avenue, just off Jasper Avenue. The address is 10557 109th Street. You can check out our event on Facebook. So that's December the 6th. The 150th episode of the High Level Showdown live. We're going to have our doors open at 7, and the show is going to start at 7:30, and it's going to be a fun time for all of us. And I think also it's going to be a bittersweet time, because the 150th is going to mark the end of a chapter in our three hosts' lives, isn't it, Elliot?
Yeah, after the 150th episode, we are going to be retiring the High Level Showdown. We're really proud of the body of work that we've created over the last 3.5 years. We are really happy that we've had an opportunity to do this, and all the opportunities that have been afforded to us because of it. But we just think it's time to move on, and we thought 150, it's a nice round number. So maybe that's more of an incentive this year to get your live show tickets, because that live show will be the last time that the three of us are all together podcasting on stage as the High Level Showdown.
It's been such a wonderful journey, and, you know, special thank you to Jeff Williams and everyone at G Radio who have really helped promote the show. Jeff is the one who pushed us to go weekly, so thank you, Jeff, for increasing our workload and bringing more content to all our listeners. And then, of course, a really big thank you to Karen Unland, who was really listening to the show from the very beginning, having the show on Seen and Heard Network, and then, of course, bringing us along and inviting us to join the Alberta Podcast Network powered by ATB. So thank you so much, Karen. And of course, to all the listeners, our friends and our family, and all the new friends that we've actually made as being part of the show. It has been such a pleasure for all three of us every week to get together and yell at each other and truly have the best showdowns and bring you great content. So thank you so much, everyone.
Yeah, and I also want to thank, Elliot and Sharon, of course, for this journey, right? And yeah. Elliot and I, of course, we started it, and then, you know, Sharon came along down the road. But it's what you know, as Elliot said, it's been 3 years, 3.5 years of.
It's been a hell of a ride. It's been a lot of fun. Yeah. It's been awesome to see you guys every week. That's been a big.
So thank you to you two, and of course, again to our listeners.
Welcome to episode 149 of the High Level Showdown. We are proud members of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. My name is Sharon, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Michael and Elliot. How are you doing, guys?
Well, I haven't had an outraged tweet thrown at me by an enraged boomer yet this morning, so I'm doing okay.
That's good. Fantastic. Yes, I'm well.
All right. And I'd like to just let everyone know that was the first time I have recorded the intro without doing 5 times and messing it up. So, you know, I think it's very fitting for the last
time. The last time around the table, you got it right.
I got it right. If we had a blooper reel of all the times.
Better late than never, I suppose, right?
Yeah, it would be like literally 150 episodes worth of content of me messing that up. So,
it's true.
Yeah, we're back in business, and I think very fitting. Our first topic that we're going to dive into is about media. So this week, Bill Morneau announced a lot of different funding that was happening, coming down from Ottawa, and great news for news organizations. The government pledged nearly $600 million over the next 5 years to help news organizations struggling to adapt to the digital age. So as we know, they say that print is dying, and lots of local and civic publications have really been suffering. And so this...
RIP View Weekly.
Homies, yes. So this allows, you know, nonprofit news organizations to accept donations, issue tax receipts. It actually gives tax credits for people like us who subscribe to local news You know, there's lots of different things that will help boost, hopefully boost, local news organizations. So, I mean, on first read, this is great news. Like, woo, yeah, we need news, especially in the age of fake news and Trump. We want strong journalists reporting. But it has actually drawn some criticism from people, kind of saying it's state-funded media. I think the conservatives said that, you know, Justin Trudeau is trying to buy the media, and now that they've funded them, that we're going to just get glowing news about the the liberals. Well, what do you guys think about this?
I mean, I think traditionally, besides certain outlets like, you know, National Post or Globe and Mail, which will have the conservative bent, I think generally media is always accused of having the leftist bias, especially the CBC, which has, you know, been often labeled as the liberal soapbox, and of course it is a crown corporation, so you know, sure, I think there is always a danger, of course, of biased media, but I think protecting having a healthy and robust media is important for any democracy, and I'm personally not suspicious of the government's motives in terms of having a state-sponsored network, you know, like the types of things you would see in Russia or, you know, any country that is not a healthy democracy.
I mean, I have to... This, to me, is a bit like buying a pipeline in the sense that this appears to be a federal government that's investing in a dying form of media. I think that we've shown with this show, for example, or across
a
number of different
podcast
platforms
that wouldn't have existed, you know, 15
media.
Years.
Yeah, this is new
people
media.
Come to us for their hard-hitting news.
Exactly, right? So, but I think we've seen that there's a new form of new types of media. There's new ways in which to engage in the journalistic process. And those, along with a confluence of other events, have really taken a bite out of the traditional media sources. I'm not sure that a strong democracy is dependent on really strong conglomerate media organizations. And it seems as though this money is largely funding those types of organizations, the Globes of the world, the National Post of the world, the people that are doing the most poorly right now. Whereas there are groups that are cutting through that and making a marginal living and doing good journalistic work. I think Jesse Brown is an example at Canada Land, who's basically crowdfunded his entire journalistic enterprise and company, and has built, you know, they're doing outstanding reporting right now on Indigenous deaths in Thunder Bay, which we've talked about, I know, previously on the show. They're going after the We Foundation right now and talking about some of the stuff that's going on with that organization, right?
I didn't know that. I want to listen to that.
Oh, it's very interesting stuff. They're actually in a lobbyist case too, but but what's been going on is really interesting. So anyway, you can sort of crowdfund good journalism. I would much rather see money go towards journalist schools and journalist, you know, creating like a bar type system for journalists to self-regulate themselves in some sort of way, so that you have sort of a quality control index associated with that. That's sort of my initial piece to this. I know that this came out of Canada-wide consultations. The CBC has been involved with that. Lots of different organizations have been a part of that. But I am a little bit concerned that a lot of this money is going to go to dying forms of media, and I would rather see Canada revolutionize new media and create new ways to create journalistic
standards. But you're also
saying
that dying forms of media then shouldn't be resuscitated, then they should be allowed to die, is what you're saying.
Right? I think so. I really do.
You know, trying to keep a terminal patient alive, is that what you're saying? It's futile?
I mean, let them die gracefully?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Well,
I mean, like, you know, how much money are we, is that what we're trying to do, or are we trying to resurrect a dying form of media? Because I don't subscribe to a newspaper. Sharon, I don't know that you do.
No.
And Michael, do you?
No, I don't.
So, our generation just isn't doing that, right? And now there's new forms of internet websites that classifieds used to be a huge piece of revenue for these guys. That's not ever going to come back. That's never going to exist.
Yeah.
So if these guys aren't transitioning with the growing, changing industry, why is our government supporting them?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point, Elliot. One of the things that was pointed out in some of the reports was that the plan doesn't actually tackle the main issue, which is plummeting revenue, ad revenues, like you're saying, the classifieds. So some Canadian publishers have argued that, you know, foreign companies like Facebook or Google that dominate the advertising market benefit from unfair advantage by avoiding provincial sales tax. So, I mean, that's a very big topic to tackle, yeah. right? But, like, mm-hmm. you know, now ads, no one buys, like you're saying in the newspaper, you know, even things that I promote through work, it's always social media, Google, yeah. Instagram, Facebook. That's where people are getting their ads out there. And, you know, some now Edmonton Journal, you can buy online ads and things like that, but there's still a key piece of this that you're talking about that this doesn't tackle. So although I really like this news and I think it's great, I think supporting local and civic journalism is really important, but it also doesn't really solve the main problem, I think. It doesn't go far enough. And I don't know what the solution is. Obviously, we can't just have the government funding all the journalists in the country.
No, absolutely.
So it's like, what is that balance? Do media publications have to keep thinking about different ways to innovate and, you know, broaden their revenues?
And this comes off a week where the UCP bought like a wraparound piece of the Edmonton Journal.
I loved looking at all the journals with Jason Kenney's smiling face at us.
So, something that would be 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, 5 years, no, maybe now closer to 10, like the hardcore journalists, the idea that a political party could buy the front page of a newspaper.
Well, I mean, and
that
they would be didn't deemed, buy it. The car company, what the truck company.
Yeah, Stronger Together or whatever. Yeah. Stronger Helper. Mixing up Hillary Clinton's slogans. No. the notion that that would be something that would even deemed acceptable, let alone now a necessity for
it.
Newspapers to think, like, you know, this is where we've gotten to as a news media institution. I mean, you know, one of my favorite things to do is take an article, a nationally run article in a post, so an Edmonton Journal. Let's say that's a story about Finance Minister Bill Morneau. Take the headline, throw it into Google, and see every newspaper that shows up as the top hits in Google, because they're just reusing the same amounts of news. They're making less money, they're making more cutoffs, and their quality of news reporting is going down. I'm not sure if $550 million over 5 years is going to make, you know, is going to revolutionize the media industry.
Yeah, and oftentimes you see these chains, they have Associated Press articles that are distributed to all the, you know, CanWest or to all the journals. It's the same article.
Yeah.
In the Edmonton Journal, in the Calgary Sun or Herald or, you know, whatever it is, but it's the same article.
Well, Herald and Sun, they're all owned by First Media now. Yeah. So that's the other thing. There's been this this takeover. Post Media has had to gobble up more and more newspapers to be more to attempt to be sustainable.
Yeah.
And really they're gobbling up assets, but their debt is far beyond what they're going to be able to deal with. They're basically managing the company in the ground into the nicest way possible. And I think that why aren't we encouraging new forms of media? And perhaps there is money in there for that. I would be surprised if there wasn't.
Like more revenue for like podcasts and like different like interesting.
When's High Level Showdown going to get that money?
Justin Trudeau, write us a check. Cut us a check.
I have been defending your policy on electoral reform for long enough.
The truth comes out.
It's the last show. Yeah. It's going to be loose.
But that being said, and this goes back to this other point we brought up at the beginning of this discussion, but is this a nefarious attempt by the government to have a biased media?
I don't think so. I think that this has been well consulted on. This has been a conversation that's been going on for a long time. In fact, who's the CEO of Post Media? I forget his name. He's been lobbying for this some type of government intervention for quite a while now.
Yeah.
And so to see it finally come to fruition, in a way, I don't think that Post Media and many, you know, news organizations are really, really want to see. But this has been a conversation that's been going on for a long time. But the conservatives also feel as though the media is always a bias against them. I mean, the reason why this like fake news sort of trend has gone forward, I mean, that's originated out of the United States and Donald Trump, but we certainly see it come through here quite often as well, too. There is a perceived liberal bias for something like the CBC, which is also another state-funded broadcaster, something that we haven't talked about as well either. And how does that impact perceptions of that institution, the integrity of those institutions? Do I think that it's liberals buying favoritism? No. But I think it further draws into question the integrity of these organizations if they are accepting public funding dollars. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I would say so. So I guess what I would glean out of this is, can these forms of media evolve to survive? I mean, I guess they don't even have a choice. They have to, because the demand is not – the demand for the traditional forms is not what it once was.
But this sort of subsidy delays that process, right? And it undermines new people coming up who are having success, because that means that, you know, this reinvigorates a little bit of a fire in some of these more traditional news industries, mm-hmm. let's say. That's counterintuitive to what the market is demanding, what the market wants, right? I want my news. I want it free. I want to be able to get it in my ear. You know, that's important to me. So I want – that's where I want media to go. The CBC's made a move towards that. You see lots of post – the post-media ventures have started to do that. Does this offset that innovation because it's a tax, you know, break for 5 years? That's always my question.
Tune in to Let's Do Coffee, where local entrepreneurs, students, or alumni are interviewed about their ventures into entrepreneurship. Each episode, the hosts dive into topics that explore the challenges, questions, and fears each individual has or has had when operating their companies. Let's Do Coffee is presented by the Maji Center for New Venture and Student Entrepreneurship at NATE. Check out episode 3, where the hosts interviewed Edmonton local designer Candace Wolf and asked her what it was like, what it is like to be an interior designer and how that plays into her business. They asked her what challenges she may have faced along the way and where the company is going. So check out Let's Do Coffee. Okay, so we're going to stick with the federal government and its legislation, and one that has been very contentious, of course, is how the government is handling the ongoing strike of postal workers, the ongoing strife between the union, the Canadian Union of Postal
Are
Workers,
you booing and the Canada workers? Post.
Yes.
So we're recording today.
Not the CUPW.
So today we're recording on November 24th. And so last night, the Labor Minister, Liberal Labor Minister Patty Hajdu, tabled back-to-work legislation because it's been about approximately 5 weeks of rotating strikes across the country, which has caused a significant backlog in mail delivery, particularly for parcels. So the Labor Minister tabled back-to-work legislation, which passed the House of Commons by a vote of 166 to 43. The Conservatives voted with the Liberals. Now that bill is in the Senate and, of course, will likely pass there and then become law once it receives royal assent. So the government is saying, get back to work, because we are entering the Christmas season. Of course,
we need our presents.
Yes.
Capitalism.
There's been an economic disruption, and it is time that this halt comes to an end. And of course, the critics are saying, well, this is infringing on the rights of the workers to, you know, to strike and to assemble as a union. And so I think fairly there is points to be made on both sides here, of course. So the question is the government acting fairly right now, or is it, you know, merely just bowing to pressure of consumer demands?
Sharon, I know you want to get into some of the more details around the negotiation. I think it's important for context. So I can talk a little bit about the money. The union has gone into this wanting a 2.9% increase. The government, they're actually not that far off. The government has offered them 2.0% increase with a $1,000 signing bonus. So that's the issue here, though, predominantly is not based around dollars and cents necessarily. It's more so around working conditions and how the organization is structured. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, there's lots of different demands, but some of the main things that postal workers are striking for is, one, the discrepancy between urban and rural postal worker pay. And so urban postal workers are paid by the hour, rural postal workers are paid by the size of their route. And so essentially what that means is usually that urban workers get paid a lot more than rural workers. And there's an added layer, which a lot of people have raised as well, is that there's a gender discrepancy as well. So most urban workers, the majority of them are men, whereas rural workers, the majority of them are women. So it's this weird kind of layered issue where because of the structure and then, you know, the gender disparity, then yeah, the women postal workers are making less. And so people want to, you know, equalize that, that they should be paid the exact same amount as their urban counterparts. And then another big thing is overtime. And so a lot of workers are saying that Canada Post, instead of hiring more workers to fill the routes that are needed to, they're often forced to work overtime to be able to meet the demands of their route. And this increases a lot of problems. So you're working more hours, you know, now packages are getting heavier. They're saying there's lots of workplace safety issues. If you've ever walked around Edmonton in the winter, half the people don't even scrape the ice off the sidewalks. There's lots of safety issues, you know, that postal workers are, you know, the job is getting harder and we're working more hours and we're not being fairly compensated. And there is a lot of support in terms of, you know, whether it's benefits, whether it's, you know, support for us if we're faced with safety issues. So those are kind of the main issues about, you know, working overtime and labor and stuff like that. And then that pay discrepancy. And there's a lot more, but those are kind of the main sticking points.
Yeah, that seems to be where everyone's kind of landed. I mean, it is a particularly injurious job. I think that there's like, they're five times more likely to encounter some sort of workplace injury compared to any other federal employee in the government, which is, I think, very interesting and quite telling, but also speaks to the physicality of the role. And
workplace injuries actually have increased by 43% in the last 2 years for postal workers, which I found very surprising. I was like, wow, that is a big jump. And so they want to be protected, right, when they're out there and, you know.
I mean, you would also assume those federal employees, they do have quite good benefits in terms of workers' compensation and those sorts of things as well, too. I mean, this is part of a larger conversation that we're having, not unlike the conversation that we just had around media, around changing industries and changing expectations. Because I think that our society is moving towards more online shopping, more online sending of packages.
Yeah.
But how do those things get from one place to another? And how does Canada Post fit in with private distributors of parcels, which is another whole piece of this conversation as well. And Amazon, who seems to be creating their own distribution network themselves as well, too. Right. So that's a big piece of this. I mean, I remember one of the big hot topic issues in the last federal election was this whole conversation around mailboxes in communities. And
they were going to eliminate the door-to-door delivery.
Yeah. And instead create, you know,
community boxes.
Community boxes. And the union was quite against that at that time. Of course, that would likely mean it was a cost-saving operation, less postal workers, which every union, you know, they're putting forward a notion there's going to be less workers. But it also does seem like it would create a much more sustainable sort of job practice and flow, you would think. Yeah. So I think that that's my way of saying that there's longstanding issues between this union and the federal government. And on top of that, a changing economy and industry is also having a major impact as well. I mean, I think it's interesting that they are so close on money, but they're still so far apart on the other issues that they still haven't signed a deal. Right?
Yeah, I mean, like, the idea that they want an overtime ban so they can only work 40 hours a week and 8-hour days, like, that's standard. The fact that they, like, don't even have that, you know, in their collective agreement is a little stunning to me.
So
right?
Is that they don't get paid for more overtime, those hours, or they're working overtime to complete
their
routes?
Forced to go on overtime, right? So it's not really an option. So often there is lots of overwork that happens because they have to go and finish other routes and different things like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a really complicated issue, and none of us are labor experts or anything like that. But I think the point of this that I find very contentious is the federal government stepping in the middle of an agreement like this. And basically what this does is take away the bargaining power of the CUPW and the workers, which I think is a really bad precedent to set. And it just, I don't really love this interference.
I would say, however, I personally don't feel that it's fair to characterize the government as the bad guy. I mean, what are you supposed to do? I mean, we need this service, right? And it's not like, and I could even agree if they just went on strike 2 days and they're already interfering. This has been a process of about 6 weeks now of rotating strikes. Yeah. So there has been the ability for negotiation. In fact, Canada Post even made a number of offers to the union. So the ability the ability to strike has been you know, allowed, and there has been an exchange of dialogue. But at a certain point, we need a resumption of services. You know, this is, again, tying back to the economy. What is the government supposed to do? I mean,
help appoint more mediators, help facilitate this.
Well, I think they have appointed a mediator, and that's been one of the issues that they've been dealing with.
I think it's unfair to say that the government is being bad.
I think it is a very slippery slope in terms of the government stepping into this. Because now, basically, it puts...
Sherry, at what point would you have them hold off until? I mean, they've acted now after 6 weeks. How many more weeks would, you know, I ask you in this instance, would you have them wait?
Now that I'm thinking, you know, I'm just going to take the stance right here, and I just decided that I don't think the federal government should interfere in agreements between a union and...
But even if they are the employer, I guess. But I guess, like, so here's my thing. I am not a big fan. I actually really do not like back-to-work legislation. The only time I think back-to-work legislation is important or appropriate is in the... instance of essential services.
Well, so you saw an essential service.
Well, that's I think that's a question. But here's the
thing. Especially in this season.
Okay, but
is it life or death?
Well, for some it might be. I can't speak to that. I don't have a package in the mail that's going to save my life.
But here's, I got to further to this point though. I think back to work legislation in essential services, when you've got an entire workforce that has stepped off the job, that's not what the Canada Post employees have done.
No, it's rotating.
They've done rotating strikes.
But it's yet it's still.
It is having an impact.
It's caused a huge backlog.
Absolutely,
right?
It's had an impact, and particularly around. I got a little inside baseball on this because I do a lot of direct mailing at work, particularly around this time of year, and so I'm getting every 2 days I get an update as to what's going on, right, where the backlogs are, and they're having major issues at the Vancouver distribution sites, Toronto and Montreal, because that's where a lot of international packages are coming in.
But a lot of local foreign countries to stop shipping. Yeah. Right?
But a lot of local services are, just 2 or 3 or 4 days behind schedule in terms of getting the mail out to where they need to go. So that is all like contextualizing around the idea of whether back-to-work legislation is appropriate. I do think it undercuts the union's capacity to negotiate
completely
in this situation. And I think doubly, this is the most important time of the year to talk about mail carriers. And there's a reason why this is why every contract goes up at this time of year, because this is the pressure that they're able to put on. So if you legislate them back to work through their busiest time of the year, when it's the most relevant to people, and then you come out in November or in January after the busiest time of the year, you really undercut the union's capacity to negotiate. And I'm not sure that I have an opinion on this. I understand, Michael, your perspective, and Sharon, I understand yours in terms of why you agree and why you don't. And I'm not sure that I have a position one way or another, but I do agree with Sharon that this does undercut the postal workers. And maybe their demands are unacceptable and the government's
And I don't know. I can't. Like I said, I'm not an expert on it. I just read a few articles the same as other people did. But yeah, this is just the sticking point for me where I just don't. That back to work bill, I think it completely undermines them. And so now the Canada Post has nothing to lose. It's like, well, you're back to work during this busiest time and CUPW loses their ability to negotiate. And then now what? They have to take a deal that...
I don't know if they lose their ability to negotiate. I mean, I don't know.
Michael, Come on.
I don't know. I wouldn't
use
that.
Well, there'll just be a bunch more packages lost in the mail this year, right?
I wouldn't
use that. Let's take a larger view on this, because I don't think we're going to come into any conclusion on this.
Everyone's just fucking pissed because their shit isn't coming in the mail. Like,
yeah, but that's what the paid social workers do.
Shop local, you know? Visit your local whatever.
But
buy presents
that can't be the case for everybody, and you know that, Sharon. So, and you can't expect people to have
I bet the malls are
that.
Thrilled, because malls are also dying. You know? Talking about dying.
I mean, again, this is...
it's true.
Is the government going to be seen as... Well, they're anti-union, but are they also going to be anti-business, too?
Well, that's what the
businesses
critics are saying.
Need
Jack
this Meat service.
Was fired up.
So this is my...
Well, Jack Meat needs some.
Hold on. Let's zoom out a little bit, because you guys aren't agreeing on this. High level. Michael, you shared a post, an article, or maybe Sharon, you did, in our Facebook group this week around how a weak NDP is the best thing for the Liberals.
Michael shared that,
right? There's an article, a whole conversation around if the NDP sucks, it makes the Liberals better against the Conservatives.
Yeah.
Is this not throwing a bone to the NDP by the Liberals?
And
Jake Mead, who's been like out in Burnaby in the middle of the ocean,
I think
doing
they finally
who knows
called
what.
That by-election.
he's actually made Jake Mead relevant in this situation as well, too. I mean, not that you should be dictating policy and back to work legislation based on politics, but doesn't that have some sort of impact?
It definitely does help Jake Mead.
I was just going to say, when the Conservatives got their majority in 2011, one of their first pieces of action was, again, tabling back to work legislation.
And they failed.
Five years after.
Yeah.
Right. But I would say the NDP were the official opposition at the time. In fact, Jack Layton, who, you know, he didn't have much time as opposition leader. Those were some of his best question periods when he was grilling Harper on.
It definitely helps Jack Mead, right? For sure. It helps the Liberals. I mean, especially,
the
you
NDP.
Know. Sorry, the NDP, because this is, you know, their bread and butter, right? It's, you know, labor, labor and union. So, but I don't think the Liberals really care because, I mean, yeah, it might throw a bone to them, but it's not enough.
Well, I would agree with that. I don't think
it's drowning right now, right?
Well, I mean, I think you can very see a very clear path here where you pass it back to work legislation hesitantly, then you immediately get a deal with postal workers right away to go back to work where you make some concessions. The union votes on it and votes for yes, and then all of a sudden you look like you've done well by the union, and that's sort of how these things go anyway. I mean, and then are we going to be talking about postal workers when the Liberals are up for election in 2019? I mean, unless they're still not working, or unless they're still quote-unquote
on
strike.
Will the postal workers be pissed?
Yeah, I mean, sure.
So will they
lose? I mean, there's but if you lose, like, I don't know how big their, you know,
their voting block is.
Their voting block is. I don't
a
know.
A lot.
I mean, there's lots of posties out there. There's families of posties too.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's interesting. You never know with these things. But back to work legislation, I don't know how I feel about it. I actually feel really uncomfortable about it.
It does make me very uncomfortable.
No. But I also understand, Michael, why. You know, you would feel as though we're moving towards postal work being an essential service.
I'm ready to just say bye to my packages that I'm waiting for. I don't care. Sorry, John, you're not getting your Christmas present.
Not John's Christmas present. We're part of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATV, and we have partner podcasts. And the one that we want to talk to you about this week is the Well Endowed Podcast, which is a podcast that comes out of the Edmonton Community Foundation. They are up to episode number 34, and this week they interview Trevor Phillips. He joins them to share his thoughts on integration, the currency of outrage, and why it's important to keep having conversations about race, even if you don't always get it right. Trevor Phillips has a great deal of experience talking about race. He's the founding chair of the UK's Equality and Human Rights Commission and was previously the chair of the Commission for Racial Equality. He is the creator of the thought-provoking film, Things We Don't Say About Race That Are True, and it's an awesome episode all on the Well Endowed Podcast. Check it out, www.thewellendowedpodcast.com.
Okay, let's move to the White House, and it is that time of the show. It is
Trump Watch.
Right. So, remember 2016 campaign? What were some of the
darkest days of my life?
Yes. What were some of the most recurring chants?
Crooked Hillary.
Lock her up.
Well, maybe we should resurrect that, lock her up, because it seemed that there's an insider in the Trump presidency. The Trump's Trump's own daughter, Ivanka, his beloved Ivanka, who he has a weird obsession with, and you know, we'll go into that. Well, it's been revealed that Ivanka may have done things that are very similar to what dogged Hillary Clinton throughout the 2016 campaign, yet doesn't seem to be the same reaction from the White House or from Donald Trump. Very interesting. So, Sharon, please give us details. What did Ivanka do? What is she accused of doing?
Well, Ivanka, you know, while she was transitioning into her role into the White House and at the beginning, aides were very surprised at the volume of Ivanka Trump's personal emails. And so she was conducting, you know, government business using a private email server, using her, you know, probably her fucking Gmail or something. Who knows? And actually, what was more hilarious to me was when questioned about this, her response was that she didn't know the rules. She didn't know that it wasn't okay, which is just like ridiculous. Yeah. Because as you noted, the emails were really the reason why Hillary Clinton lost the election. When, you know, yeah, what the fuck is Comey?
James Comey, yeah.
Comey ruined the election and threw it. And so Ivanka Trump and her people are saying, you know, we didn't know this was an issue. Sorry.
And of course, daddies are fine with that, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But I mean, this again, I mean, we've talked about this a lot, and I don't know what other layers. Elliot looks like he's about to lose his goddamn mind. Are you okay, Elliot?
This segment might be the only thing that I don't miss about this fucking show.
The Trump one.
But, I mean, guys, do you think... Okay, I'm going to ask a question.
Well, it's hypocritical.
You think she really didn't know?
It's hypocritical, certainly. You know, you part of you feels like, well, you want to give her the benefit of the doubt. But the vile rhetoric that this administration and, you know, her father spewed, you know, I feel like she doesn't deserve that benefit of the doubt.
I mean, yeah. I mean, then part of me is like, is this a bunch of fucking emails? Like, who cares?
Well, I mean, that's how we all felt. It's a bunch of fucking emails. Who cares? But it's just the hypocrisy.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Well, like, and then we got, and then, you know, you had investigation after investigation after investigation by a Republican-controlled Congress about pertaining to Hillary Clinton's conduct and the way in which she acted, particularly around emails. And then James Comey, and you know, it wasn't the emails per se, but James Comey's press conference a week before the election that really swayed it, the election towards Trump in those final days, that left people embattled and angry. I mean, I think one of the things that we've come to find in the last 2 years, since we do this segment every week,
yeah,
is just the blatant hypocrisy prevalent in all forms of American government and the American institution that is government. And I know we spend a lot of time talking about how Republicans are just like, do this stupidest shit like this and go after Democrats for the same shit and then, you know, just look away when it's their own people. But Democrats do it too.
Oh, yeah,
and I think what we've come to see is that there's this sensationalization of the mundane that comes from that sort of like left-right bipartisanship polarized partisanship that is so detrimental to the average American middle-class individual on the ground. Because we continue to see a society in the United States that is divided, oftentimes around racial lines, oftentimes around wealth lines, education lines. You see issues in essential services like healthcare and education that are crumbling at the state level, for some states, simply because they have a moral objection to a black man creating a health policy that would be beneficial to the people in their province, in their governorship.
He's a Muslim, okay?
Like, that is it's politics over the people that you're meant to represent. And this sort of news, it epitomizes for me what the problem is with the American system of government right now, which is that it's it's politics, and it's attacking over what's good for people. And politics should be for what's good for people.
Yes.
And that is what frustrates me about this, is that when you see it, it's like, oh, it's just a bunch of stupid emails on a private server. Yeah, it was dangerous, but whatever. You know, she's sending Betsy DeVos, like, love letters. And Linda McMahon asking for tickets to the next WWE event in Dubai, which you and I have to have a conversation after.
No, I'm not. I don't support that.
But then when you think about that same bullshit led to a major swing in the electorate, because there's not enough social infrastructure in America to provide governance education to people, and people like Trump sees it. So I don't know. I went on a rant there. I'm tired of this fucking segment. I'm tired of Trump. Fuck Donald Trump.
Forever.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll end it with the 780 then. Elliot is never
prepared. I'm prepared. I prepared this week. Look, I'm prepared this week. I put it on the chair. This week, I got to go to the opening night show of Miss Bennett, Christmas at Pemberley, which is at the Citadel all throughout this holiday season. It's sort of a sequel to Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, that's cool.
Which wasn't going to necessarily be my cup of tea, but my good friend Brentley, his little sister Emma Houghton, she is one of the actresses in the show. She does an outstanding...
You can just say actor.
I can, actually. Yeah, I can just say actor. I knew that, too. She's one of the actors in the show, and she's outstanding as one of the sisters. I've never seen Pride and Prejudice before, which is...
Or read it.
You don't necessarily need to have to watch this show. I will say, for anyone out there who's got a potentially romantic opportunity for a date...
It's
a good date show, and I said taking a partner to the theater is always very romantic to begin with,
are you
too.
Listening?
But the show is actually really quite cute and enjoyable. Really young cast, young director who does an outstanding job. You're really starting to see a transition, I think, in the people that you see on stage at the Citadel.
That's awesome.
In terms of diversity. And there was more women in this cast than men, which is not something I've seen in a theater production in a while.
Hey.
So it was awesome. I really encourage you to go and check out the Citadel's show, Miss Bennett, Christmas at Pemberley.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it only took me 149 episodes, but I got my 780 ready this time.
I'm proud of you. And a true 780 straight from Edmonton. I'm going to continue the trend with my 780, Edmonton-based. So the holiday season is so fun. I'm already ready to play Christmas music. I'm putting my tree up today.
Okay, calm down.
It's lit. But we know often that the holiday season isn't great for everyone. As we have abundance, people demanding their packages from Canada Post because they bought so much shit.
Michael turning on his fellow worker.
Many people who are going without this holiday season and, after it. So, first of all, there's lots of opportunities. If you would like to give back this holiday season, you can do that in many ways, either monetarily, or there's lots of organizations that do look for seasonal help to make things happen. So I'd encourage you, to go online, find some places that you can volunteer, give back. Volunteerconnector.org is a really great website, or just looking at local organizations. But even more than that, the holiday season is a really popular time to volunteer, and often organizations after the holidays are like, oh, where are all these people that were really into volunteering? So I'd really encourage you, if you're interested in giving back, the holiday season is really popular, but carry on that spirit after the holiday season and think about how you can give back to your community, even on event or whatever it is. It doesn't have to be, weekly and all the time. And so as you're enjoying your families and your fun, think about those who aren't and think about ways that you can give back. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, it could be as small as giving someone a bit of change and treating them with respect. Michael, totally. You.
That's right. I want to recommend a movie. Of course, Oscar season starts. We're getting into it, so I want to recommend Green Book to our listeners, and that's with Mahershala Ali and...
Oh, I saw that. I love Mahershala Ali. I saw the the previews.
Right, so he, Mahershala Ali and Viggo Mortensen, and it's based on a true story. In the 1960s, of course, in the segregated southern United States during the era of Jim Crow. And so we have this acclaimed jazz pianist, and he says, I'm going to start a tour of the South. Well, what could be the problem? Well, wait a minute, he's a black man. So, of course, there's a problem traveling through the southern United States. So his driver is a white man, Viggo Mortensen. And, you know, it's a journey of self-discovery, of course, confronting segregation, racism, and one's own personal prejudices. It's a very touching movie, and it's also very funny. There's a lot of very, very funny moments in the movie. And it's emotional. So I think it balances the seriousness of the material with comedy, but it doesn't mock the situation at all. So it's very very touching. I really recommend Green Book. And the performances are particularly, I have to say, Viggo Mortensen really stood out to me. I kept thinking, wait, this is Aragorn, you know, from Lord of the Rings. He does a really good job as the driver here, Tony Vallelonga. So watch out for Green Book. At the Oscars and at the other awards coming up, I'm sure it will appear and probably take home some hardware. So that's a recommendation for Green Book.
All right, awesome. For the last time around this table, Sharon, where can people find you?
You can always find me at SharonMVU on Twitter.
I'm at Maestro Michael too.
Just don't at me this week. But after that, at Tanti Yeg. We are at High Level Show. Guys, it's been a pleasure to do this around the table with the two of you and with our listeners.
We'll see you at the 150th.
150th.
That's
the
Grizzlar. December 6th.
Grizzlar. Yeah. Be there or be square. You're gonna wanna see it. It's your last time to see it. This amazing thing that we do.
Thanks so much, everyone. See you December 6th.
Good night.